And we're glad for the presence of everyone here, and if this format of kind of being down here with you doesn't work real well, we'll make other arrangements. But I thought, since we had to start so far back, I've always been taught in evangelism to go where the people are, and so that's why I'm here. And I appreciate the invitation to be here this week with you. And what I have done is selected to go along with the theme of being a servant, to select Abraham to concentrate on, rather than a different person each night. Let's just get all we can out of one section of Scripture. Now, just to kind of give you a running start, we are in the book of Genesis all week long, and Genesis chapters 1 through 11 is talking to us about people driven from land. That's really what those chapters are constantly telling us. People are driven from land. Who's the first one driven from land? That's it. Then Cain, and then, of course, Noah experienced that. And, of course, now we're in chapter 11 already, and we're at the Tower of Babel, and we find that land is another issue. Now, what did land mean to people? Pardon me? Wealth. It meant a little more than material wealth. Wealth to them meant a lot more than just having things. A birthright, and it had a lot to do with being on the good side of the creator of the universe. Had a lot to do with one's perception of whether or not God was with me. It was a symbol that God was with me to have land. And so when they are driven from land, they are constantly trying to find ways to get land. And in Genesis chapter 11, they are going to try to get it by earning it. And we find that earning land, earning fellowship with God, never works. It never works. And so we're going to see a contrast in chapter 11 between those who are trying to earn their land by asserting themselves and getting it on their own, to those who are servants of God by just humbly submitting and responding to the directives of God. He gives gifts. And the gift is going to be land, chapter 12. So if you look at Genesis chapter 11 and verse 2, these people at the Tower of Babel scene, where all the languages, by the way, came from, you wonder, well, where did languages come from? Well, they came from this scene of Genesis chapter 11. Verse 2 said, "And it came to pass as they journeyed from the east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there." And in chapter 11 and verse 4 said, "And they said, come, let us build ourselves a city." So they're asserting themselves. They're earning. They're creating their own thing. "A tower that is to the top of the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves." So here again is the prestige, the making a name for ourselves, the popularity. We're still driven by that. Man has always been driven by that. You know, he's trying to create his own utopia. He's trying to make a name for himself, notoriety, lest we be scattered abroad of the face of the whole earth. So they're panicking, and they're creating their own land. Then look at chapter 12 and verse 1, see the contrast to that. God's going to give the land. It's a gift. You don't earn a gift. Now, you have to accept the gift. There are conditions laid down for a gift, but you didn't earn it. It's just a gift. And so we find if you were to have a wedding shower, it would be nice if you'd show up in order to get the gifts. And so chapter 12 and verse 1 says, "Now the Lord had said to Abram, get out of your country, from your family and from your father's house to a land that I will show you." That's not easy to just uproot. If you've been here in this town for all your life and you were told to leave all your family and friends, it wouldn't be an easy thing to do. But if you are devoted to God, you'll do whatever he directs you to do. Not that he is speaking to you like that today, but he certainly did to Abraham in the Word of God. There are all kinds of doors that open and responsibilities we have to do things that may necessitate we be uncomfortable. God is not real concerned about our own personal comfort here in this earth. He is concerned about our devotion to him. He's concerned about saving our soul. And if that means you being uncomfortable, then he would say, so be it. And so here we find that in chapter 12 and verse 1, this land is a gift. Chapter 13, verse 17, "Arise and walk in the land through its length and its width, for I will give it to you." It's a gift. And so from the fact that they're going to create their own land to the fact that God would give them their land if they'd just been faithful, Now look back at Genesis 11 and verse 4. We're just kind of comparing back and forth the contrast between earning this land, which was symbolic of fellowship with God and God being on their side, to Genesis chapter 12 and what faith does. And we're talking this week about faithful servants, so we're setting it up this way. Chapter 11, verse 4, and they said, come, let us, they're not consulting God, we're going to do this because we want it. Let us build ourselves a city, a tower that reaches the top of the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad. Now, look at chapter 12 and verse 2. There's your contrast. God is going to give them greatness. God is going to make a name for them. He's going to make their nation great. On the other side, in chapter 11, they were going to make a name for themselves. Well, all you have to do is be humble and submissive to God, and He will put you on display. That's what evangelism is, essentially, is God putting His people on display. And it is the attractiveness of the life of the people, because God dwells in them, that will draw people to Jesus Christ. Now, if you're not satisfied with the amount of people that you as a church are converting, you have two places to look. Either you are putting yourself on display and every member here is shining brightly and people just don't want it, or we find that we ourselves are not having the Lord live in us to the point where it's sending any signals that anybody will want to be attracted to it, or a combination of both, obviously. Genesis 12, 2, I will make you a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great. You concentrate on that. That's the whole idea of servanthood. You shall be a blessing. God is blessing him. He then, on display, is a blessing to other people. That's what it's all about. That's the cycle of evangelism. That's the cycle of servanthood. Now, what they did in chapter 11, verses 6 through 9, is they earned judgment for themselves. That's what they earned. All they earned out of this whole deal was judgment. Look at verses 6 through 9. And the Lord said, indeed, the people are one. They shall all have one language. And this is what they began to do. Now nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language. And so that's where languages come from. Therefore, its name, verse 9, is called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth. And from there, the Lord scattered them abroad upon the face of the earth. So here they were wanting one thing and got another because they didn't trust God. On the other hand, you see verses 2 and 3 of chapter 12. We already looked at verse 2, but let's get a running start into verse 3 by looking at verse 2. Genesis 12, verse 2, I will make you a great nation. I will bless you. I will bless you and make your name great. And you, highlight that, I'm blessing you, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. He's going to protect and take care of those who are servants. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. And of course, the ultimate of that is Jesus Christ. He is the one, his seed is going to bless, of course, the world, in that it will provide an opportunity for forgiveness of sins, thus permanent removal of sins, something that had not been known until, of course, the death of Jesus Christ. Genesis 11:4. You could just see it. All they're doing is serving themselves and their powerful achievement. And you know, I just mentioned that, and I'm not going to ask for a show of hands. Did that point just kind of go right over your head? You know, in other words, it's just kind of a preacher thing, and you know, we're just kind of talking here. Did you know what I just said could save your marriage if you have marriage troubles at any time in your life? I've just given the key to solving every marriage problem on the face of God's earth. Oh, you did? Yeah, I did. Well then, why didn't you say so? Well, let me go back and get that again. Well, let's do that. It's that important. It will heal the grudges and the relationships and make them better. Here's what it's all about. I will bless those who bless you. I will curse him who curses you, and in your families all the earth shall be blessed. And then in chapter 11 and verse 4, and they said, come, let us build ourselves a city. They're serving themselves by their own powerful achievement. What we do in marriage problems is we accentuate and dwell on our pain. That's self-centered. And so what preachers often do, or elders often do, is they're trying to ease your pain. That, ladies and gentlemen, is not where the emphasis ought to be. easing your pain is not God's ultimate concern. That's not his ultimate concern. But that's what we often do. We just want to ease people's pain. No, he says you're going to have to grapple with your pain and realize the reason you got the pain is because you're dwelling on your pain and you're self-centered. Now, if you'll get God-centered, then things will be better. And only then will things be better. I know of people in the church who spend anywhere from $50 to $85 an hour to counselors in marriage, and the whole thing is spent on easing pain. And the root of the problem, which the Bible clearly spells out, never dealt with, self-centeredness. Well, as we go on here now, Genesis chapter 12, verses 2 and 3. In a sense, the whole world and Abraham began this long trek back to God. So we're actually going home. And that's what verses 2 and 3 is talking about. Men are now going back to land, but ultimately going back to be at home with God, because through sin, they're actually separated. So Adam is a fit representative of sin, one who's separated from God. And here we find that Abraham seems to be the representative of a man of faith and fellowship and being back with God. Romans 4:11, let me read that for you. Romans chapter 4 and verse 11. And he received a sign of circumcision, a seal of the righteousness of the faith which he had while still uncircumcised. Here's the key. That he might be the father of all those who believe, though they are uncircumcised, that righteousness might be imputed to them also. So to all the nations, Abraham then's opening the key to the door of my going home. And that's what life is all about, getting back home, getting back in fellowship with God. Now we're not looking for literal land, but the symbol of it, it's what it symbolizes, and that is fellowship with God. That's really the key to life, and you can't do that by being self-centered. So he says, I will make you a great nation. I'll bless you. I'll make your name great. You shall be a blessing. Be thou a blessing. But why do some people have so much and other people don't have as much? Well, there's a lot of reasons for that. A lot of reasons for that. Some are very religious. You take the people in India, among the Muslim people, their belief is what keeps them starving. They got plenty of resources, plenty of land, plenty of fertile soil. They've got a lot of our grain that's just sitting there infesting with bugs because they don't believe they can touch that food. They don't even believe they can, because they believe that they're being punished. And so if you give them food, then they think, well, that's not right, because this is my punishment to be this way, so I can die and come back as someone else or something else. And keep coming until finally I reach that nirvana, the top, where I can die, and that would be the top when I don't have to come back as anybody anymore. I got it all right. So religious convictions sometimes cause a lot of trouble and pain. And frankly, we're wasting a lot of food just sitting there because they religiously don't even believe in getting a hold of it. It's against their belief, and here we're just wasting food over there. But the idea that I'd like to share here is that one of the reasons, of course, is the only thing that vindicates God in giving us so much is that we share it with others. And if we don't, then we'll probably lose it. So the only thing is, well, we're so blessed. Well, all that means is I have a responsibility to give, see? And if I hoard, then that's not the purpose of God. He says, I'll bless you, Abraham, and you be a blessing to other people. That's the cycle. It's not meaning that we're special, we've merited it, we're better than anybody else in the world because we have so much. God's just saying, I've chosen you as a people, I'm going to bless you, and if you don't use it, I can easily take it away and give it to somebody else like Russia or somebody else like that. I can easily do that. And he's done it in the past. Maybe he's even up to that now. I don't know. Genesis 12:7. God uproots him from his home, because this is not his home. He's a pilgrim and a sojourner. In order to be a blessing to others, he's got to move. And that's not an easy thing. He goes from Ur of Chaldees up to Haran. His father dies in Haran. He goes to the land of Canaan. And he thinks, well, this is it now. We can finally settle down. And that's not true. There's a famine that strikes. He goes down to Egypt. lies about his wife being a sister, and he did it to save his own neck. We don't have to talk about white lies and half lies. It's a lie. He did it to save his neck. He did it again 20 years later. God was not pleased. And he was a bad influence and ends up going back to Canaan again. So his life is constantly on the move. And guess what? His wife always went with him. She always went with him. Genesis 12:7, they traveled to Canaan. Then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, "To your descendants I will give this land." There it is, give this land. "To your descendants," not to you, "to your descendants." And there he built an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him. So he thought everything was going to be okay, and here he is on the move again. Now look at verse 10. "Now surely he was pleased that the mystery was all cleared up and everything was fine. He'd now arrived. He can settle down." Well, no. "Now there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down to Egypt to dwell there, for the famine was severe in the land." God didn't tell him to go. He didn't consult God. He just went. Now, 62 years later, look at Genesis 23:4. 62 years later, out of frustration, "I am a foreigner." Now, he's going to confess this to some Canaanites. He was an alien in their land, and he's telling them this. I'm a foreigner and a sojourner among you. Give me property for a burial place among you that I may bury my dead out of my sight." And even though this could be legitimately interpreted, and we can just have it all making him look good, there are a lot of occasions in his life where he wasn't so good. Faithfulness doesn't mean that we have absolute sinless perfection. It means that even when we blow it, we have the resiliency and humility as a servant to admit it and come back to the Lord. And that's what he's looking for. He's looking for us to depend on him to be the one who restores us. And if we don't have faith that he can restore us, then we're never going to admit we're ever lost or ever have a rough time and admit it to someone else. There, instead, we're going to reflect this prima donna image that is phony and false and not genuine and hide our real selves from others, and we'll never grow like we should. Well, I think that Abraham reaches this point where he feels God's let him down. God hadn't let him down, but you get to feeling that way sometimes. Have you? Have you ever prayed a lot for something and just met with disaster? I've known of people who prayed for years and years for a child, and when the child was then born, it was maybe mentally retarded. It wasn't what they prayed for, and they had to deal with that. There are some who prayed for marriage, and they're still single. They prayed for a mate, and it's never happened. There are a lot of disappointments like that. Maybe a wild child breaks your heart, and you prayed all your life that your child will be faithful and that he'll return to the Lord or she'll return to the Lord. That hadn't happened yet in your lifetime. Maybe the child's already dead, and now you're having to live with the pain that your prayer is not answered. Could be you have a lifelong illness, and you felt that pain for a number of years, and you don't think that's fair, and you don't know why that's happened to you. There's a lot of feelings that a true servant of God will go through. Let me just say that there's a lot of people who have left here through the years, and they're still living here in Payton City. And I will say that some of those never told you the truth about how they really feel. They may have said, "Well, you know, I've got a lot to do. I've been busy, and I just hadn't come back to church." Or they might say, "Well, you know, so-and-so over there, you know them, and I'm just not going back and worshiping with them." When really, the real reason is they feel God let them down. And I found this out through the years in dealing with people maybe years after they quit going to church. That was really the reason. And I also know of some really good people who are not going to obey the gospel until you can somehow, they accept the baptism. You've been talking to them about that for years. That's not their problem. The problem there are millions of people are having, that if we're going to be servants of God, we're going to have to help them as well as project what God's true image is, and that is that he doesn't let people down. Now, we feel that he has, and yet there are some things we need to think about. Look at Jeremiah 15:18. Jeremiah felt God let him down. You can see this very clearly. "Why is my pain perpetual?" He's asking God. "And my wound incurable, which refuses to be healed. Will you surely be to me like an unreliable stream? He's saying this to God, ladies and gentlemen. He's asking God, are you going to be an unreliable stream to me? And when I want water the most, you're not going to give me what I need? I'm just going to die? Are you going to be as waters that fail? Now that was about 600 BC. Let's go back 800 years and let's go to the time of Moses in Numbers chapter 11, verses 10 through 15. Numbers chapter 11, verses 10 through 15. Now here you've got a case where Moses is complaining to God. And that's another thing you'll find about a true servant of God. They will complain to God when they've got to complain. I mean, they have such a close relationship with God, they will express their true feelings to Him, even though those feelings are pretty bitter. They go ahead and say it. Abraham did it, and Jeremiah did it, and every faithful servant of God has such a relationship in prayer that if they've got a complaint, they don't complain to anybody else and misrepresent God. They go straight to Him. Numbers 11, 10 through 15, now Moses heard the people weeping throughout their families, everyone at the door of his tent. Now, how would you like that? You know, this is what it feels like to be an elder of the church, a one that's really involved in the people, where the people really come to them and trust them. They're wore out. It's a full-time job. To carry a job and be an elder is probably the toughest thing on the face of the earth. I don't know of anything tougher than that. So we find that the people are all crying at his door, and he's getting pretty tired of working with people. He's getting tired of it. And the anger of the Lord was greatly aroused. Moses also was displeased. He felt the same way about it. It's God, except, listen to this in verse 11. So Moses said to the Lord, why have you afflicted your servant? So here's a time where a servant of God thinks that God's afflicting him. God's making it rough on him. So Moses said to the Lord, why have you afflicted your servant, and why have I not found favor in your sight? We're talking this week about servants and how servants feel and how servants can serve. One thing they're going to have to do is get over these frustrating moments they will have. If you haven't had them, then you haven't really experienced what it's like to be a servant. That's all I can say about it. Because all the faithful ones in the Bible have experienced this. So he says, and why have I not found favor in your sight, and you have laid the burden of all these people? You know, if I found favor in your sight, you wouldn't send all these people to wear me out. Give me a break. Verse 12, did I conceive all these people? I mean, you know, I feel like I've got them all. And I didn't give birth to these folks. I didn't ask them to come into this world. Did I beget them that you should say to me, carry them in your bosom? Why do I have to take care of these people as the guardian carries a nursing child to the land which you swore to their fathers? Where am I to get meat to give all these people? I mean, I can't take care of these folks, for they weep all over me. Can you imagine? Say, they weep all over me. You ever felt like that? Give us meat that we may eat. I'm tired of hearing them. I'm not able to bear all these people alone because the burden is too heavy for me. If you treat me like this, please kill me here and now. If you as God want to keep treating me this way, end it. You got the power? Stick a sword in me? Get rid of me. I don't want to be here anymore. I'm tired of fooling with these church members. That's what they are. Church of Israel. You ever got the feeling that way? I have. And I've complained to God about it. I wanted to quit preaching in this capacity in America. Complain about everything. Well, he's not even on the pulpit stand tonight. It's not right. I don't have a verse for it. That's just the way I feel. And your feelings are more binding than Scripture. But I wouldn't dare mention that to you. And so he complained. Now look at Job chapter 9. Here's some more. Faithful man, righteous man, none better. Job chapter 9, 25 to 32. Job chapter 9, 25 to 32. Now my days are swifter than a runner. They flee away, they see no good, they pass by like ships, like an eagle swooping on its prey. If I say I will forget my complaint, I will put off my sad face and wear a smile. Yeah, that's what some of us do. You know, how are you today? Fine, fine. How are you? Fine, fine, fine. You're lying. But I know you don't want to just say, oh, I'm terrible, I feel lousy. I know you don't want to do that either. So we're all kind of perplexed about being honest to each other, because you don't know who to be honest to, you know. Some people, you ask them, how are you today? And they give you the whole detailed anatomy of everything that's wrong with them, and you wonder how they're still breathing. Verse 28, I am afraid of all my sufferings. I know that you will not hold me innocent. If I am condemned, why then do I labor in vain? I washed myself with snow water and cleansed my hands with soap. I'm living right before, you know, that's quite a, you know, he's not boasting. I mean, he honestly is telling God, I'm living right. I was always taught, Job says, I'm always taught all my life that if you live right, this stuff shouldn't happen to you. Well, I don't know what else to do. I don't know what else to do, and yet you will plunge me into the pit. Now, why are you plunging me into the pit? But that's only supposed to happen to people who are sinful, and I'm not sinful, so, and my own clothes will abhor me. Imagine that. Man, he's just really sensitive here. For he is not a man as I am, that I may answer him. So the idea is, through the ages, what we do is we say, well, God's not going to talk to me. Here, I'm talking to him. God, why don't you talk to me for a change? You ever felt like that in prayer? You know, you're talking to him, you're begging him. You say, oh, well, I thought so. You weren't going to say anything to me anyway. Why do you have me praying when you're not talking back? He's wanting an answer. He's not going to get it here. Not here, not in this form. Well, there are no easy answers to all of this, of how you feel when God lets you down. But I do have some things I'd like to say tonight from the Word of God that might be helpful. And the first thing is don't give up on God. And that's the success of Abraham and Job and Moses and Jeremiah. They never gave up on God. They kept on going through their trials and their pain and their frustrations and constantly depended on God, even during those rough times they were having and feeling. Genesis 17, 18. Now, if Abraham, the servant of God, teaches us anything, it's that. He groans a protest when he hears Ishmael isn't heir. And Abraham said to God, oh, that Ishmael might live before you. But he never gave up. He never gave up. And we'll see that. By the time we get to Thursday night, you'll see the apex of his faith. It's so great in his giving his son, willingness to give his own son. Tremendous. Deuteronomy 32, 3-6, Moses, this man singing God's praises. So he got through his rough moment. I'm going to read that song for you. Deuteronomy 32, 3-6. Deuteronomy 32, 3-6. For I proclaim the name of the Lord, ascribe greatness to our God. He is the rock. His work is perfect. So he's admitting it's his fault for complaining. God didn't do anything wrong. He knows that now. He feels better about things. For all his ways are justice. Well, what was he saying a while ago, folks? You're not fair. I just want to die. And hey, we all have those moods. We express them to God. He works that out for us. He opens doors. We come back to him, a God of truth and without injustice, righteous and upright is he. Verse 5. They have corrupted themselves. They are not his children because of their blemish, a perverse and crooked generation. Do you thus deal with the Lord, O foolish and unwise people? He's telling them they're unwise and they're foolish because they didn't trust God, and yet he knows he's gone through moments like that too. Is he not your father who bought you? Has he not made you and established you? Think about what all he's done for you, folks. So the idea is don't give up on him. Lamentations with Jeremiah, Lamentations 3:22. Lamentations. That's Jeremiah and then Lamentations. It's a whole book of his tears. Through the Lord's mercies, we are not consumed. This is Jeremiah. The Jeremiah who said, why is my wound perpetual? Why is it incurable? And then he says, because his compassions fail not. You see what he's teaching? He's compassionate. See, over here in chapter 15, he's saying, you just don't care about me. And then over here he says, you are a God of compassion. That is what a servant goes through. And they are real and they were genuine and they are honest people. Well, let's look at Job, how he got through his too. Job chapter 42, 10-17. Job 42, 10 through 17, and the Lord restored Job's losses when he prayed for his friends. Indeed, the Lord gave Job twice as much. Now, that's not why Job came back, because he got twice as much. He didn't play let's make a deal here. He was willing to accept God now because he saw how great God was, thus how small his own circumstance was, and that God could take care of him because God was taking care of the universe and everything he made in it. And it was at that point of faith, then God just decided to give him the gift of this restoration. Verse 16, after this, Job lived 140 years, saw his children, grandchildren for four generations. So Job died old and full of years. So the first point is, don't give up on God. These people did not give up on God. Don't do it. It's not worth it. It's not wise. These fellows know how you feel. They've been through it. Second point is to accept our own spiritual limitations. Sometimes we crack under the pressure because we take the whole world and all its burdens on ourselves, and some are not doing a thing while others are doing too much. That's just the way life is sometimes with people. Some of us are doing basically nothing and could do something, and others of us have got the whole world on our shoulders. We're going to take care of everything. And Romans 12:3 is talking about our spiritual limitations. And I guess what I'm saying is we need to find balance with God as we live and know ourselves, be open to the challenge to grow, not be complacent. But we're not Jesus. So we're going to have to pray and ask him to do some things, open some doors, make it easy on yourself. That's what he's there for. Cast your burdens on the Lord, for he cares for you. Romans 12:3 says, for I say through the grace given to me to everyone who is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think. See, some don't think anything of themselves. They run themselves, I can't do this, I can't do that. They don't have any confidence in God, and they're not using the gifts that we talked about Sunday morning, the talents. While there are other people who are just thinking too much of themselves, as if, well, the church wouldn't be here without me. Pretty arrogant. Maybe it'd be in better shape without you. Oh, God forbid I think of that. And so he says, not to think of yourself more highly than you ought to think, but to think soberly as God has dealt to each one a measure of faith. See? We all have talents, so use the talents of other people. You know, there are some leaders that are good administrators, and some just do it all. And the ones that do it all are just not good leaders. And that's what even Moses had to learn from his own father-in-law. Romans chapter 12, if you're still there, verses 6 through 8. Having then gifts differing according to the grace that is given to us, let us use them. And we read this yesterday. We went through the ministry and teaching and exhortation, whatever your gift is. Utilize the gifts of the body. So accept your spiritual limitations. The third point is to stop viewing God as a heavenly sweetheart. There are people who just believe that God is in this whole thing to serve their every whim, that God is their nurse. And that his whole goal in life for you is that you be totally comfortable while you're here. And that's just not it. God isn't as interested in making our life so easy. He wants us to be strong and deep and rich in our faith. So a servant's life is not necessarily an easy, comfortable one, even though there are moments of great joy and great comfort. He'll always be loving. He'll always be loving. But he will not always be gentle. God will always be loving, but he will not always be gentle. He won't always be gentle. So where are we? Well, we're thinking about our attitude toward God. When we get frustrated with him, we express it. Number one, don't give up on him. Number two, accept your spiritual limitations and realize God is not a heavenly sweetheart. That he loves you, but he's not always going to just do things for your own comfort. John 16:33, these things I've spoken to you, that in me you may have peace, in the world you have tribulation. You will have tribulation in this world. You will have trouble. That's what he's saying. You will have trouble. So there's the expectations. As you hear sometimes these radio preachers some of them are famous for promising that if you obey whatever gospel they put forth. They say, if you just, everything will be fine. You want that Cadillac, you'll get it. You want that, you'll get it. You'll get it. And if you don't get it, then you're not right. And then you got the guilt trip because you didn't get the Cadillac, and it just goes on and on. He says here, you're going to have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I've overcome the world. And what he means by that is I've overcome your world. Your possibilities look bright as the promises of God, because you can now, through Christ, overcome lust of flesh, lust of the eye, pride of life. Your sins can be forgiven. So when God lets you down, try to keep yourself out of the center of the picture. Why me? God's saying, why not you? Okay? That's what he's saying to us. Secondly, make sure that you aren't creating your own pain. A lot of troubles we bring on ourselves anyway. We really do. I'd like for you to turn to Deuteronomy 28. There are people that, as we talk to them about being servants of God, they blame God for, well, if God was a God of love, why are there tornadoes and hurricanes and all this stuff? Why are there diseases? Well, let me take you to Deuteronomy. By the way, in the Garden of Eden, no such thing existed. Who brought the problem? Who? Yeah, man made the wrong choices. So he messed up. He made the wrong choices. He messed up. Somebody want to get the phone? Thank you. Now in Deuteronomy 28, I want you to really hear all the promises that he's making. Everything that anybody you've ever talked to has ever wanted. Good weather. Hey, how about good weather? How about no diseases? How about perfect crops? In Deuteronomy 28, he promised all that. I want you to really look at this. Prosperous cities. Go home and read this. In the rural areas, no sterility among the men and women and livestock and the people, and he assured them of success in farming, dependable weather conditions. Isn't that what we always, God's not a God of love, because if he was a God of love, he'd give us all this. God's saying, okay, I'll give it all to you if you're faithful to me. If you're faithful to me, I'll give you what you want. So the fault again is us. He even guaranteed military victories. He guaranteed immunity to diseases. Now look at on the other side. The violence, the crime, the poverty. If you don't obey me, you're going to have violence, crime, and poverty. You don't obey me, you're going to have infertility among your people and livestock. You're going to have crop failure. You're going to have locusts and worms and scorching heat. And you're going to have drought and blight and domination by other nations and fever and blindness and confusion. So all we have to do is be faithful to God, and everything we've ever wanted we get. How long did that last? Ladies and gentlemen, within 50 years, that's all it took. The Israelites were already a total sham. Couldn't even be faithful for 45 years. And everything they ever wanted from the God of love, they would have got. So the idea is, when people come up with that, if they were God, was God of love, he wouldn't allow them for earthquakes and all that. Say, hey, we're the ones who blew that. There was a time where if that's all we needed to be satisfied. But see, when you get everything you want, you're still not satisfied. That's the point. That's the point. So the fault is us, and God knows that. But he gave it all to us anyway. He said, hey, I'll let you have this. This is what you always wanted. We don't want it even when it's given to us on a silver platter. So when the New Testament author looked back on the history of this, he's telling us that man is incapable of fulfilling a covenant, a contract with God. That's why you need Jesus Christ. You got to have him, because you're just not going to make it on your own. You're never going to be satisfied. And so the only satisfaction, the only fulfillment in life is going to be Jesus Christ. So one of the complaints people have as I encounter them as a servant of God and try to talk to other people is they just believe God's too silent. That's one of the big complaints, is God's too silent. Why doesn't God reveal himself more plainly? Again, I point to the fact in history, he did. He gave a tabernacle. And when he said, go, what'd he do? What'd he do when the people were supposed to go, what did he do? The cloud moved. The fire moved. So it's pretty easy, right? I mean, you don't have to scratch your head and say, what should I do? I mean, If the pillar of cloud is still there, you stay. If it moves, you go. So he's not silent. He wasn't silent. Did that help them? Were they faithful because of that? No. They weren't satisfied with that. They had the priest had the Urim and Thummim and communicate through it. That satisfied? No, that didn't satisfy them. They had 613 codified laws as very specific. Did that help them? No, that didn't help them either. Didn't help them. There's people who have the truth that really aren't together in life. That doesn't mean anything. Just because you have the truth doesn't mean you're saved at all. Externally, if you just have the truth and that's it, you're going to have a relationship with God that's very deep and genuine and honest. And so God is silent is one complaint. Another complaint, did the first bell ring? Oh, great. The second complaint is that God is hidden. Where is he? Why isn't he more visible? Well, they had the manna in the wilderness. They had all these things that God wasn't hidden. He filled their stomachs up with all this food, but they still said, where is he? So man's not going to be satisfied. That's why the only thing that God could provide that would be Jesus Christ. So try keeping yourself out of the center of the picture. Make sure you're not creating your own pain or your own problems. And number three on this is keep the love of God central in your thinking. Our advantage is we've got Jesus in the flesh who lived before us, and hopefully we'll be able to take this God-conscious Abraham. That's what he was. That's the thing that pulled him through life. It wasn't the doctrines that he had. I'm not saying they're unimportant. I'm saying there are some people who make a God out of doctrines. And what I'm saying is that when your heart goes to God, you will follow the doctrine. First, get first things first. God must be center in our thinking. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the key to the servanthood of Abraham. He was a God-conscious man. Did he sin? Yes. Did he bounce back? Yes. Did he get through his frustrations? Oh, yes. That's what servants of God do. And did he respond immediately to everything God said? Yes, he did. Did he sometimes jump the gun and listen to his wife and become a calloused, hen-pecked husband? Yes, at times he was. But he got over that too, tried to deal with it. Did he have family troubles? Yes, a lot of them. Was he always a good father? No, he wasn't always a good father. Mean he wasn't always a good father? No, he wasn't always a good father. Are we saying now you don't have to be a good father and still go to heaven? We're saying that the key to life is a God consciousness. A resiliency that is constantly asking God to forgive him, to go to that altar. That's the key. So we'll dismiss for now if you want to take a short break, and then the children will be up and there'll be a few songs and questions, and then we'll have an invitation in just a little bit. Thank you for your attention.